From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen, and this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross has the day off. On this edition of Fresh Air, we're happy to present a concert with guitar virtuosos Sergio and Odair Assad. Their music is a mix of the Brazilian pop they grew up with and the works of South American composers like Villa-Lobos and Astor Piazzolla. Also today, we meet novelist Paul Auster. He was a poet and translator before he became a novelist. That experience has given him a lean, economical style as a writer. World music commentator Milo Miles checks out the music of Haiti, and critic Laurie Stone checks out this year's Academy Award winner for Best Foreign Film, Cinema Paradiso. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. South Africa's President F.W. de Klerk said today that he'll use all his government's powers to bring an end to the escalating violence between rival black groups in Natal Province. NPR's John Madison was there today.
The official death toll reached 37 for the week today, but human rights workers say the real figure is more than twice as high. The conflict is between Nelson Mandela's African National Congress and followers of Zulu chief Mangosuthu Buthelezi. A public meeting was arranged between Buthelezi and Mandela for Monday in one of Buthelezi's strongholds, but has been postponed because Mandela wants time to consult his allies in the area first. President de Klerk said today that on Monday he will announce strong new measures to end the carnage. He hinted that the conflict threatens his planned negotiations for a new constitution. The violence is at its highest level in 3 years of fighting, and human rights workers in the provincial capital Pietermaritzburg fear further escalation next week. I'm John Madison reporting.
Panama's new government today rejected a call for new elections from 7 Latin American nations. Foreign ministers from the so-called Rio group made the statement after a 2-day meeting in Mexico. They said Panama needed a new election without foreign interference to legitimize the election process. A spokesman for Panamanian President Guillermo Andara said that Panama doesn't need new elections because the people decided in May of last year. Andara is believed to have won that election, but it was later annulled by dictator Manuel Noriega. The U.S. invasion of Panama in December ousted Noriega and installed the Andara government. Chancellor Helmut Kohl and Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher concluded talks in London today, sorting out some of their widely publicized differences. NPR's Jackie Lydon reports.
Earlier in the week, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and Chancellor Helmut Kohl had a falling out over whether the Chancellor would guarantee Poland's borders. But at the annual Königsberg summit in London, relations between the two vastly improved. Chancellor Kohl said he supports a united Germany in NATO and agreed to Mrs. Thatcher's demand that American, English, and French troops stay on foreign soil after unification. The two differed on a timetable for a united Europe. The Chancellor urged Britain to join the European monetary system and hasten its timetable for European unity. But Mrs. Thatcher said that for the moment, things were right as they are. I'm Jackie Lydon in London.
A federal appeals court judge in San Francisco today blocked next Tuesday's scheduled election of convicted double murderer Robert Alton Harris, saying he may not have gotten competent psychiatric help at the time of his trial. Stocks fell sharply on Wall Street today in moderate trading. The drop followed an overnight sell-off in the Tokyo stock market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 20 points to close at 2,707 on volume of 140 million shares. This is National Public Radio News. The State Department said today that a Libya plant alleged to be producing chemical weapons may still be operational, despite a fire there earlier this month. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said the possibility could not be ruled out that the fire was an elaborate hoax on the part of the Libyan government. Boucher told reporters that there are uncertainties regarding the cause and extent of the damage at Libya's Rabta chemical plant. He said the possibility remains that Libya can still produce chemical weapons. The new government assessment contradicts earlier reports that said the fire had put the Rabta plant out of commission. Ohio's attorney general is trying to get the Federal Energy Department cited for contempt of court. The dispute centers around a southwest Ohio nuclear facility where radioactive leaks and pollution have occurred for years. Bill Cohen of Ohio Public Radio reports.
Ohio Attorney General Anthony Celebrezze is charging the federal government and the Westinghouse Materials Company of Ohio, the operators of the Fernald Uranium Enrichment Plant, have both violated a 1988 consent decree in which they had agreed to clean up safety violations. According to Celebrezze, thousands of barrels of thorium, uranium, and other radioactive materials may be rusting through, and he says they're being stored on top of a pad that has cracks in it, so any leakage will end up in the ground, polluting it and any nearby water supplies.
We're not going to lie down. We're going to keep after this facility until it's operated in a safe manner.
Celebrezze is asking a federal judge to order the Energy Department and Westinghouse to clean up their act and fork over some money as a penalty. For National Public Radio, this is Bill Cohen in Columbus.
The Supreme Court agreed today to act quickly to decide the constitutionality of an anti-flag burning law enacted last year by Congress. The court will hear the case on an emergency basis and issue a ruling before its summer recess. The fast action will assure that the cases will be decided in plenty of time to become an issue in the fall congressional elections. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The Los Angeles Times called our guests a badly needed boost to classical guitar music. They're Sergio and Odeir Assad, and today we'll hear a concert of their acoustic guitar duets. The Assads grew up in a small town in Brazil, where during the 1960s they listened to and performed the indigenous music of Brazil, as well as North American pop songs. They were discovered while in their teens and taken to Rio de Janeiro to study classical guitar. The Assads have two albums out on Nonesuch Records. The latest, Alma Brasileira, means Brazilian soul and is devoted exclusively to Brazilian composers. The first song we'll hear today is a composition by Argentinian composer Astor Piazzolla titled Escolaza.
Thank you. Wonderful. Thank you very much. Let me reintroduce you. My guests are Sergio and Odeir Assad, and they're from Brazil, and they're brothers. They've been playing together for many years. Sergio, I know that you both compose and arrange other people's works. I'd love to have you do a piece, perhaps, that you have arranged from someone else's work.
Okay, I think I would choose a piece by Egberto Gismonti. I think he's one of the finest Brazilian musicians.
This is a piece that you've kind of worked with. Was it written for guitar originally?
No, it's a piece that was written for piano. But he played this in a lot of different arrangements. And we decided to make another one.
Wonderful.
This piece was recorded by other musicians also. It's a quite known piece. It's called Frevo. Thank you.
Wonderful. I want to talk to you a little bit about your playing, because when I hear you, it sounds like one guitar and four hands. It's almost telepathic. I mean, that.
I think the explanation for what we do is we have been playing together all our lives. I mean, we started playing together, and we kept that way for over 20 years now.
How old were you when you actually started playing?
I was 12, but we have a difference in between us two. I mean, whether he is 4 years younger. So when I started, I wanted to start it before, when I was about 10, but my father didn't agree with that. My father is a musician himself, but he thought that the guitar was too complicated for me. So I had to prove to him that I was able to play, you know, a few chords.
How did you do that? How did you prove it to your father?
Oh, I tried several times. I remember that the first time I tried, it was his birthday. And I, you know, I played just in the first string, you know, happy birthday to you, but it didn't work.
That didn't work. So what did it take?
Well, I think I had an uncle of mine that came to visit us. You know, he knew to play a few chords. And for the first time, someone showed me how to make those chords, right? And I learned quite quickly.
What was it about the guitar that you wanted so much to play?
I think our house was full of musicians all the time. My father had a lot of friends coming, you know, all the time. And most of them, they were guitar players. So we had this fascination for the guitar. It was somehow, it was, I mean, a guitar is not difficult to buy.
So
and,
make
you know, we always have a guitar hanging in the house, you know, and my father had guitars there. So it was a natural way, you know, to pick up the guitar and try to play it.
What kind of music did you grow up hearing? Was it mostly Brazilian music, or did you hear American popular music as well?
We always heard all kinds of music, but my father, he had his own favorite kind of music, which was kind of Brazilian folk music, mm-hmm. that's called choros, right? Which is kind of instrumental music, like, let's say, he has the same kind of feeling for jazz music, that you have to improvise and so on. That is a very good base for any musician, because you don't learn harmony with the paper and pens, you know? You learn harmony playing.
And I get the feeling, and just listening to you set up this afternoon as we were getting ready for the concert, is that you play all the time. I mean, it sounds like there's always a guitar in your hands. Or close by.
I think when we decided to, or we're choosing this to be our profession, you know, we try to be the most perfect possible. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, but we try.
Well, in your music, there are all sorts of styles. There's classical, there's obviously your own Brazilian classical and kind of popular music, there's jazz. Do you feel like you're kind of setting up your own kind of individual kind of music? What do you see as the kinds of influences in what you, I suppose, both perform and compose?
Well, the thing is, we were wondering, what are we going to do with this? I mean, we wanted to play outside of Brazil, because in Brazil you can't find work. I mean, it's quite difficult. It's Brazil.
Yeah.
So we started traveling, and but we were afraid of playing Brazilian music or this kind of thing, because we were classical guitarists. So we did for 2-3 years. Then people started to ask if we could play this and that, and we started doing it, and we started to have this feeling that they enjoyed much more that kind of music than, you know, straight classical things. Then we started to make two different parts and play, you know, South American music and, you know, classical. And as we admire very much, you know, composers like Gismonti and Piazzolla, we are pushing them to write things, and they did.
Well, I want to hear some more of your music, but we're going to take a quick break beforehand, and we're listening to the guitar playing of Sergio and Odeir Assad. They're a classical guitar duo from Brazil, and they have two albums out on Nonsuch Records. The newest is called Ama Brasileira, which is devoted exclusively to Brazilian composers, and they'll play more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guests are Sergio and Odair Assad, and they are Brazilian guitar players, and they're here to perform for us this afternoon. Would you play something else for us? Tell us a little bit about that particular piece of music.
This is it's a piece called Bibi, and it was written many years ago by quite known Brazilian composer. His name is Hermeto Pascoal, and many people recorded that piece too, and really like it.
How much practicing do you do a day even?
Well, when it depends on the schedule of things that we have, but we try to do the most possible, about 6, sometimes 8, sometimes 10 hours a day.
Gosh. If you're composing something, you compose obviously with your brother in mind. I mean, do you think
sure,
with
yes.
two guitars? I mean, that's the way
you
compose.
A lot of notes to give him to play.
Well, I can see that. I'd love to hear something that you composed. Maybe you could do something for us now.
Okay. We're going to play a very slow piece. It's a song. It's called Canção. Thank you.
you. It's lovely. When did you compose that?
I don't remember now, maybe 1 year ago, I don't know.
I thank you very much for stopping by today and performing for us.
We thank you so much for that.
Thank you. Thanks to both of you. And I'd love to have you kind of close out the half hour for us with another little piece of music. Sergio and Odeir Assad's latest album is Alma Brasileira on Nonesuch Records. I'm Marty Moscowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. Paul Auster says for him, writing is an act of desperation, something he does only when he's backed into a corner. Coming up, Paul Auster tells us about his latest novel, Moon Palace. Also, world music commentator Milo Miles introduces us to Compa, the music of Haiti. And critic Laurie Stone reviews Cinema Paradiso, winner of this year's Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The governor of Idaho has vetoed legislation that would have created the nation's most restrictive state abortion law. In casting his veto, Governor Cecil Andrus said the bill would not provide a woman and her family any flexibility in cases of rape or incest. The veto ended for now hopes by anti-abortion activists to challenge the Supreme Court's ruling on legalized abortion. Since the bill was first approved in the State House in Idaho 3 weeks ago, more than 21,000 phone calls, letters, and petitions have arrived at the governor's office. The White House announced today that President Bush has sent a message to Soviet leader Gorbachev appealing for a peaceful solution to the crisis in Lithuania. The letter was sent last night through diplomatic channels. More from NPR's Jim Engel.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the president's message simply reaffirmed U.S. policy to date and expressed the U.S. belief, the emphatic view, Fitzwater said, that the road to resolution of this conflict lies in peaceful dialogue. Though Fitzwater would not discuss the details of the president's message, he said it dealt only with Lithuania. Senator Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts, who just returned from a trip to the Soviet Union where he met with Gorbachev, made a previously unannounced visit to the White House yesterday to talk with President Bush. Though the White House had indicated yesterday morning it was not time for a direct message to Gorbachev from the president, it appears Senator Kennedy may have told the president something that prompted a change in that view. I'm Jim Engel at the White House.
And the Pentagon announced today that it will no longer require exports of some computers and medical equipment heading for the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe to gain their approval. However, the high-tech products will still have to pass the government study. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Pentagon says it is delegating authority to the Commerce Department to issue export licenses for CAT scanners, magnetic resonance imaging equipment, and some fairly simple computers. Critics say the Bush administration has been too slow to ease restrictions on the sale of high-tech equipment to the newly democratized nations of Eastern Europe and what is widely viewed as a less threatening Soviet Union. These critics say the Pentagon announcement today was a step in the right direction. It's nice, said one, but it doesn't do much. No decontrol is in involved, meaning that high-tech equipment previously unavailable to the Soviets in Eastern Europe will remain so. A former Defense Department official said it was an attempt by the Pentagon to portray itself as the good guy. Commerce Secretary Robert Mosbacher welcomed the move, saying it reflects the administration's understanding of changing circumstances in East-West relations. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 20 points to close at 2,707.21 on volume of some 139 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Compa is a form of popular music from the island country of Haiti. World music commentator Milo Miles says that compa has been a strong and reassuring constant through many years of Haitian political struggle, both for the people on the island and expatriates living here in the United States. Today, Milo explores the history of compa and some of its stars.
Until electronic media shrunk the world down to a golf ball, seaports and islands on trade routes had a particular advantage in world music. They were first to hear the new sounds from far away, and music trends bounced among nearby islands like pinballs ricocheting off bumpers. The Caribbean is a vivid example of the island advantage, and no island has been more gloriously eclectic than Haiti. Like its neighbors in the tropics, Haiti absorbed repeated waves of Spanish, African, French, and American music. The accordion took firm hold, often accompanied by basic but still polyrhythmic African drumming. Using this central instrumentation, the rage on and off for many decades has been the merengue. The first track coming up is a merengue from the Dominican Republic, a fairly traditional treatment recorded in 1977. The next track is by Nemours Jean-Baptiste, the grandfather of Haitian compa, and it was recorded 20 years earlier in 1957. The affinities are plain. People often forget that the 60s turned popular music upside down almost all over the world. Rock and roll, Motown, and soul not only shaped reggae in Jamaica, but influenced a new sound Haitians called mini-jazz. A respected group of young mini-jazz hotshots was Tabu Kombo. Here is a selection from their 1969 debut record. You can still hear the accordion, no horns yet, but compa is coming close. And here's Tabu Kombo 11 years later, after disco, after funk, after they've heard salsa from New York and soukous from Zaire. Compa has arrived. Tabu Kombo's closest rival for the top spot in compa is Gesner Henry, who goes by the stage name Coupé Cloué, and he too is a veteran performer. Unlike Tabu Kombo, he never adapted horns to his band. Consequently, his compa shows a distinct Afro-pop bent in the guitars, which many fans find seductive indeed. I keep coming back for Cloué's sonorous, avuncular voice. It's so vibrant and welcoming, you're always glad to embrace it. It's nice to report that there's a kind of compa primer available from A&M Records called Convit, or Working Together. Film director Jonathan Demme pulled together the old and new songs with some able contributions from the Neville brothers. You get a wide selection on Convit, from the Moore Jean-Baptiste to some very current topical protest numbers. In fact, the only snag is that Convit has a heavy-handed political agenda that leans hard on compa as activist music. It is activist, without a doubt, but it's more than that, and the best songs are not invariably protests. The fans are just as persuaded by the dash and dart exchanges of horns, drums, guitars, and voices that climax dance workouts. Here's GP Express winding up to a big finish on a song called Eh 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 Eh. Whether compa is activist, romantic, or just raising cane at a block party, it's sturdy, smart music with more than its share of rhythmic poise and gutsy ensemble work. And there's lots and lots of it, dozens of splendid bands. Here's a sample of one more, Les Gypsies.
Milo Miles is a freelance journalist who writes about pop music for the New York Times and the Village Voice. This is Fresh Air. Moon Palace, Paul Auster's fifth novel, is the story of Marco Stanley Fogg, who was orphaned at the age of 11. The book traces his life as he learns some of the secrets of his past. Although it's a story of discovery, much of what he learns he finds out through chance meetings and events. Moon Palace has just been published in paperback by Penguin. Auster began his writing career as a poet and translator. I spoke to him when he came to Philadelphia recently to spend a week as a writer in residence at Temple University. I asked him to begin by reading the opening of Moon Palace.
It was the summer that men first walked on the moon. I was very young back then, but I did not believe there would ever be a future. I wanted to live dangerously, to push myself as far as I could go, and then see what happened to me when I got there. As it turned out, I nearly did not make it. Little by little, I saw my money dwindle to zero. I lost my apartment. I wound up living in the streets. If not for a girl named Kitty Wu, I probably would have starved to death. I had met her by chance only a short time before, but eventually I came to see that chance as a form of readiness, a way of saving myself through the minds of others. That was the first part. From then on, strange things happened to me. I took the job with the old man in the wheelchair. I found out who my father was. I walked across the desert from Utah to California. That was a long time ago, of course, but I remember those days well. I remember them as the beginning of my life.
Now you've just given away the whole story.
There it is, in the first paragraph. You don't have to read any further.
Why did you do that, though?
Well, because this is a book of memory, I suppose, more than a story in the present. Marco, the narrator, is looking back on things that happened a long time ago to him. So suspense was not my aim here, and I just diffuse the whole question right in the beginning. Has a more elegiac tone, see that way.
Does that also free you up then to tell the story? To have given away the story gives you a kind of freedom then to tell it.
In a way, and it also, I think, gives me room to comment on it, because half of the book is his reflections on what's happened to him, as well as the things themselves, the events. So I hope in this first paragraph that I'm opening up many possibilities for the reader and for the thrust of the storytelling to follow.
You have said in an interview that it's important as a writer to leave room for the reader. And I find that an interesting thing for a writer to do. And I'm interested in how you try to do that, how you make a room for the reader.
Well, there are all sorts of approaches to writing fiction, obviously. I think people are generally very used to what one might call traditional 19th century approaches still, which I think usually entails a lot of description, for example. I have problematical relation to physical description. Even though many writers use that as a way to show off their very best abilities as writers, I have this feeling that what engages a reader in books is a kind of momentum and a kind of participation in the process of reading. So that what I'm after, usually, is a certain kind of space between the sentences, if this makes any sense, so that the reader has to make a little mental leap to get from one idea to the next.
Well, when you're writing, then, are you conscious of the reader?
Well, no.
Even though they haven't read the book yet?
Not per se. Not as though I'm only thinking about the reader. I'm thinking of myself, though, however, as a reader. And I'm trying always to eliminate things. So if I can adequately convey the sense that I'm trying to get across on the page with one sentence instead of a paragraph, I would sooner opt for that one sentence, you see. So it's a matter of stripping down what is necessary. And if you have a book in which every sentence is necessary, then to me, then you've begun to write something that might be good.
Now, the central character in your latest novel, Moon Palace's name is Marco Stanley Fogg. One of the things that Marco tries to do is to live without words. And I find that an interesting dilemma you've created for him, being that you make a living by words.
Well, words are very treacherous things. And I think anyone living inside them day by day, trying to express himself on a piece of paper, feels tremendous frustration. It not only with the words, but with one's own inadequacies. But there is a sense often that words are not adequate to express the complexity of the real that we're confronting all the time. As a writer of fiction, that's what you're trying to do. So
you can only approximate what you're really trying to say? I mean, as a writer, do you feel that?
In a way. That's why I think questions of rhythm and sound are very important in, well, obviously poetry, but prose as well. I think readers really read with their skin, their bodies, as well as their minds. And sometimes a certain rhythm will convey an emotion and an emotional state much more clearly than expository prose would.
I read somewhere that you say you begin the writing process when you're kind of backed into a corner. And I guess I then saw writing as a kind of desperate kind of thing because you're trying to get yourself out of the corner, I guess. But I don't know if that's exactly what you mean.
Well, almost that. It's not as though I sit down one day and say to myself, I feel like writing a novel now, and I will discuss the question of homelessness in America, as well as the changes in Eastern Europe, and we'll see what kind of metaphysical conclusions we can draw from these problems. No, it just doesn't happen that way. A novel begins in the same way a poem does, which is a kind of buzz in the head, I suppose. You hear something, you hear a line, or suddenly a character or a situation will materialize in your head. Often I try to dismiss it. I say, well, go away. I don't want to think about this. And if that image or idea keeps popping up, I begin to feel cornered by it. It's usually something coming up deep from my unconscious, and it's not something I can control.
Why do you shoo it away, though?
I suppose I want to see if it's for real or not. Everyone gets all kinds of ideas, and I think if I went with, you know, a lot of the notions that occurred to me, I would have spent my life writing books I would have been very unhappy with and wouldn't have been able to sustain, you know, whimsical notions that flit through the brain. So it has to be very solid before I feel obligated to do it. It becomes so necessary that I feel I have no choice, and that's when it really begins.
There seems to be a kind of father-son theme that runs through a number of your books, stories, and I know that in your own life that your father died rather young. You were rather young, and died basically as a healthy man who
just dropped dead one day. Yes, yes, unexpectedly of a heart attack. He wasn't that young. He was in his mid-60s. But the kind of man you expected to live to 95. I mean, never sick a day in his life. And so it was very sudden, shocking event. And I suppose in a way the shock of it launched me into writing prose. I felt I had to respond to this somehow. And that became The Invention of Solitude, my first prose book.
And you write about your father in The Invention of Solitude. And one thing, I guess, that you learned about him was that he witnessed his own mother shooting his own father.
Well, he actually wasn't the witness. It was his brother who was the witness. He was asleep upstairs, but he was 7 years old at the time.
And in the house.
In the house, yes. It happened in the house. And that was a dark secret kept from everyone, always.
When did you learn about that?
I learned about it... I would say probably about 5 years before he died, through a completely strange set of circumstances, coincidences. A cousin of mine was taking a plane to Europe, and she sat down next to an elderly gentleman on the plane, and they started talking, and it turned out that this man lived in Kenosha, Wisconsin, which was where my father and his siblings grew up. And she told him her name, and Auster, and he was shocked, and he said, "Your grandmother wasn't a crazy little woman with red hair, was she?" She said, "Oh, yes, that was my grandmother." And he told her the story. And he, in fact, went back to Kenosha after the trip and went into the files of the local newspaper and dug out all the articles about this case, which then... she got, and then she gave it to me. So that I read it through these newspaper articles. That's how I found out. 1919, it all happened.
And what happened to her? Did she spend time in jail?
No. She at first she denied she had done it, and then she confessed, and there was a trial. It was a big deal in Kenosha at the time, and she was acquitted because her husband had been unfaithful to her, and temporary insanity, justifiable homicide. She had an amazingly good lawyer who sort of, in the most melodramatic Victorian manner of speech, made everyone sympathize with her. And that's when they went east, you see. The whole family moved.
This sounds like a Paul Auster novel.
Well, yes. Truth is stranger than fiction, let me tell you.
Paul Auster's latest novel, Moon Palace, has just been published in paperback by Penguin. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and co-host Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us what news they have for us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Marty. We are leading the show with Lithuania again today. The Soviet Union is stepping up the pressure again on that country in its attempt to become independent. President Bush has written a letter to Soviet leader Gorbachev urging moderation. We have a report from John Madison in South Africa on violence in the Natal province, and a report from Ethiopia, where food is at last getting through to areas which are beset by famine. We also have a report on electronic house arrest, the practice of using ID bracelets.
Thank you, Linda. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Italian movie Cinema Paradiso by Giuseppe Tornatore won this year's Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. Critic at large Laurie Stone says the movie's sweet without being overly sentimental.
Most tearjerkers leave you drained and cheated because the emotions aren't earned. Poignant images are merely flashed, and you go for them like a dog to hamburger. But the sentiment in Cinema Paradiso is richly dramatized. About halfway through, I got teary, and the waterworks didn't stop. I was left feeling the melancholy of growing up, separating, and losing the past. The movie opens in the present when Salvatore, a successful movie director, is called from Rome back to his hometown, a small provincial outpost in Sicily. He returns to attend the funeral of a dear friend, a man named Alfredo, who had been the projectionist in the town's movie theater. Most of Cinema Paradiso is a flashback as Salvatore recalls his childhood in post-war Italy. His father doesn't return from the war, and diminutive Toto, as Salvatore is called, is left lonely because his mother must work. But Toto is also freer than other children, and he fastens on to Alfredo because this man holds keys to the large, tantalizing outside world. The town priest insists that Alfredo cut out the kisses and sexual embraces from the films he shows. Alfredo saves the spliced bits. He is truly the keeper of knowledge, and Toto worms his way into his heart. The child actor, Salvatore Cassio, who plays Toto, is a wide-eyed sprite. He expresses wonder, hunger for knowledge, and a child's shameless drive to put his own needs before any other considerations. This boy is never innocent. There is no innocence, the movie says. As time-scarred Alfredo, Philippe Noiret is masterful. Slowly, delicately, he lets us see Toto changing Alfredo as much as he influences the boy. At first, Alfredo quotes from the movies. He's a walking encyclopedia of dialogue. But as time passes and his love for Toto deepens, he offers his own advice. He tells the young adult Toto, who is now the town projectionist, to leave home for good, to turn his back on safety and familiarity, endure those losses, and make a life in Rome. It's a brave sacrifice, for Toto has become Alfredo's life, but for Toto this relationship isn't enough. Staying home would shrivel his longings. The emotionalism in the movie is bracing rather than cloying, because the film's truths are harsh, not comforting. The grown Salvatore, played with resonant understatement by Jacques Perrin, doesn't look at the world with awe and mischief. He looks out with sadness. From the movie's first images, where Salvatore's mother is hesitant to invite her son home to the funeral, the film radiates a mood of mourning, not for simpler times because they never existed, but simply for the past, for time lost that cannot be recovered. Movies, perhaps, are our most enduring record of lost dreams, Cinema Paradiso says. Movies are a record of the evolving zeitgeist and of our own personal associations with our younger selves. Cinema Paradiso deftly evokes the power of movies to charm the senses and stimulate an appetite for exploration and change. It also conjures longings that can't be assuaged. Salvatore had gone to Rome and never returned. However, at the end of the film, when he comes home, he knows he can return again because with Alfredo gone, there is nothing to tempt him to stay. His moorings have been cut. Nothing will ever quite connect him to the past.
Laurie Stone is a New York-based writer and critic. Her new novel is called Starting with Surge. Our interviews are produced by Phyllis Myers and Amy Sallet. Naomi Person produces the commentaries and music reviews. Terry Gross returns next time. I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Terry Gross talks with jazz great Jerry Mulligan. Also, writer Steve Fishman on a very personal piece of reporting, his investigation into his own cerebral hemorrhage and brain surgery. That and more next time on Fresh Air.